From UCB Comedy Studios, this is the UCB Digital Podcast. I'm Nate Russell. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Digital Podcast. We're talking to Dylan Marin today, writer, actor, creator, and activist, about his work in digital media. Excited to jump into that conversation with him. Sophie Alkazian's here, too. Hey, Sophie.
Hi.
Fun conversation we had with Dylan.
Very fun.
It was very nice. It was early in the morning, so we got everybody at their very best.
Yeah.
But then it got real deep real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was very fun.
We began on, I think, Whole Foods. His first job was Whole Foods.
That's right.
What was your first job?
My first job? Actually, the first job I had was in radio.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
I applied to a job at a radio station when I was 14 years old by sending them a tape which said, you should hire me because I'm not legal, so you don't have to pay me. And they
said, know what? Who can resist
that? And they actually said, come on in. I wasn't an employee, but I sort of like apprenticed with a DJ for a year.
Nice.
And then once I turned 15, they gave me basically the early morning Saturday shift that nobody else wanted to do. So I went to work at 4:30 in the morning every Saturday in high school and did weather reports in between adult contemporary songs. It was really wild
between
time.
Between Celine Dion and Elton John.
But hey, good way to make minimum wage, let me tell you what.
Yeah, and I bet you know what? That position's probably a real internship now at that radio station.
Yeah, exactly.
For any millennial out there.
Well, no, it's a computer now.
True.
It's literally just a computer.
That's true.
But yeah, that was my first job. But fun to sort of go way back with Dylan and talk to him about how he's progressed from Whole Foods to now, you know, working a ton.
Yeah.
And all over the place in a very visible sort of way. We've got a big announcement here on this show. Our Maker Book Club is coming back, round two. We're excited to announce our second book in the Maker Book Club series. So you guys can stop sending so many emails about it.
Guys, stop.
Yeah.
We get it.
You
want it. You want
to read
it.
Another book along with us. And guess what? Your wishes have been fulfilled.
And this one's shorter.
This one is shorter. Yes. So if you missed the first round, we read a book that was about 600 pages. It was about independent filmmaking. And it was I had a good time reading it. We had a good time with our book club meeting. We drank some beer. We drank some whiskey. We had a little coffee afterwards and just rapped about like that book and everything that we sort of learned from it. This time, we picked a shorter book. So if you were hesitant last time in joining in, know that this book is 120 pages. So a little bit of an easier read. There's a lot of good visual aids to it. And we hope that you will join in with this. So this is a book club for makers. You can read this book along with us. We'll have a book club meeting. This is going to be in early December. We'll announce the date of the actual meeting where we'll be live streaming and recording the podcast at the same time. So you can join in with that. And if you are joining in, we'd love to hear from you as well. So you can always tweet at us, UCB Digital, or send us an email, podcasts@ucbcomedy.com, to join in the fun with our Maker Book Club. All right. Without further ado, the book for Maker Book Club round two is The Director's Six Senses by Simone Bartasaghi. And I believe I'm saying his last name right. And Simone, I apologize if I'm not. I'll get it right by the time that December comes around.
Yes.
But I've read the first three chapters.
Yeah.
It's a quick read. And it's a pretty good read. He's actually, in his first chapter here, he gives you the advice. He says, here's your assignment. There's like assignments that go with each chapter.
Homework.
And the visual chapter, the sort of concept is that he approaches each of your senses and a sixth sense. I haven't gotten to which that one is yet. but there's a sixth sense for director. But you use all those senses in your work. And so the first one he talks about is vision. And he basically talks about setting up a folder on your computer or maybe like a Pinterest page.
Oh, yes.
Where you collect images that impact you, that feel like they emotionally touch you, to use as inspiration for your work. And I was like, that's such a simple, easy thing. And, you know, it's also a very basic thing in a lot of ways. But, like, so much of, I think, pushing yourself to sort of create in new ways is about retouching base with things that are pretty essential that maybe you've sort of lost touch with.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's such a great, simple idea. It's something I already started it. I'm, like, going to keep that into it. Like, it's been helpful already. And so if that's the kind of advice and kind of creative development that you're looking for out there, we encourage you. Join in our Maker Book Club. There's literally nothing preventing you from joining.
Literally nothing.
Yeah, except maybe finding this book, which is available online. We'll tweet out a link to it. Join on in and read the book along with us and give yourself a little bit of external deadline and motivation to learn and push yourself and find new ways to create and collaborate and communicate, because that's what we're all about on this show. So hopefully you'll join us. Dylan Maron, as we said, our guest today. Dylan's work crosses a lot of different genres. There's always an activist message underneath a lot of the work that he does.
Yeah.
He doesn't define himself as a comedian, but a lot of the work trends into comedy. And maybe that's because comedy works so well digitally to communicate a message that has a seriousness to it. You add a little bit of levity. It makes it more shareable online. Either way, the work is always comedy adjacent, even if comedy is not its first objective. And so we're really excited to sit down and talk to Dylan about where that work has come from in his life and where it's progressed to, and what his process is of like creating and working to balance all of those different sort of goals: shareability, communicating a message, getting a laugh. Where do all these things rank for him, and where, how does it all sort of come together? We also timed this pretty well in terms of like a project that he's working on, because his podcast just came to an end.
Yeah.
Although, unfortunately, with the topic of this podcast, it's never going to end.
Right. I think, season one, I think the last episode of season one just came out. Yeah. You know there's going to be more.
He'll have a season two. If anybody hasn't seen this show, it's called Conversations with People Who Hate Me. And the basic premise is, Dylan takes trolls, internet
face
trolls.
Face to face. Yeah. Well, not face to face, phone to phone.
Phone to phone. But people who have trolled his work in the past online, really mean comments. A lot of them are very mean.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they're all very mean. It wouldn't be much of a show about people who hate me if it was like,
it would
nice
be funny
commenters.
If it was like, and this person just said they liked it. Yeah. I'm going to call them.
What is up with that? No. So he gets those people to come onto the show with him and has an extended conversation with them about, you know, their worldview, what led them to that comment, and sort of like making what is an anonymous comment into something that is an incredibly personal conversation.
Yes.
And like a lot of his work, it's not really a comedy project. It's, you know, it's trying to expose something about the internet and have a real interaction in a way that like is awkward at times. And it winds up, but it also winds up being very funny. It winds up being something that you have to laugh at, if for nothing else than to sort of cut that tension a little bit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But a really fun project and something that just finished coming out. So we're well timed to talk to him about the creation of that show and what's sort of on the plate right now. And excited to hopefully to benefit y'all and your work out there, whether it's comedy or otherwise, with somebody who's crossing a lot of these different genres, a lot of different goal sets for his work. As always, we had a Bronx beer while we had this conversation. We were drinking the No Resolutions India Pale Ale. Talk about crossing borders. No Resolution says live your life without any resolutions. It's a pretty high alcohol beer, 7.6% on this one. And it says here that they've got hop aromas and bitterness in a big way. That variety of hops creates a spectrum of aromas ranging from citrus, pine, musky, tropical fruit to lemongrass. Tasty little beer. Pick one up the next time that you're at the UCB, either Chelsea or the East Village, where you can find it both places or anywhere that good beer is sold. You know that it's a good place to be if they've got Bronx beer there. Bronx, of course, the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. Go to thebronxbrewery.com for more information on all of their excellent craft brews. All right, let's jump into it. Our conversation today with writer, actor, creator, and activist Dylan Maron. Dylan, thanks for doing this.
Oh my God, thanks for having me.
Here's where I want to start. I ask because your work seems to blend some formats and blur some lines of genre. How do you define yourself as a creator? Like the work that you do, how do you pitch it?
Wow, that's a great question, and one that I have battled with for a long time. Just because I feel like I have tried to fit myself into many different boxes and never have successfully convinced people that I actually fit into those boxes. And I think really have exclusively found success when I just do what I want to do and then let people classify it for themselves. The quickest shorthand I have is writer-performer. But that is so like, that's like, I'm a thinker, you know, you're sure. Like, about what?
Yeah.
I actually, it's maybe you're, feel free to kick me off this podcast for saying this, but I don't identify as a comedian.
Sure.
Because I feel, and I always felt that way. I got really into sketch comedy, or I first got into sketch comedy in college.
Yeah.
And I loved it. Like, I just loved it. And it was classic sketch comedy. It was so fun, but I was so hesitant to call it comedy because I felt like that is a genre whose title is more up to the audience to decide.
Sure.
You know, it's like, I don't know if you're going to find it funny. I find it engaging, and I think I'm taking something I'm noticing and kind of refracting it through a lens for an audience to see. But, like, if you laugh or not, that's up to you. You know, maybe you see it as drama. So the show that I was doing at the UCB with Joe Firestone, mm-hmm. Ridgefield Middle School Talent Night, you know, it's a 17-character middle school talent show that she and I perform all the parts for, that came from like a sad place for me of like the trauma of middle school.
Yeah.
I can't speak for Joe, but that's definitely my place. And so I remember someone came to see it and he said, I loved it. And I found this play profoundly sad.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, great. You know, it's not a comedy to you.
Yeah.
I mean, to most people it is. But so this is kind of getting around your question, but how do I classify myself? I've always had a really hard time doing that.
Yeah.
Never. There's not one word that I've ever really landed on that feels right.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you say that because from the outside, it feels like you're not identifying as a comedian, but you're in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it also feels like, you know, that saying that's like tragedy plus time, right?
Mm.
Which has something to do with why a middle school show might appear comedic in hindsight, because you can't live, if you're still living in middle school now, you're still living through that trauma now, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
In a way that, like, you're probably not going to get on stage and explore it.
Right. And this was a catharsis.
Yeah,
in ways. And I just want to be clear, I don't mean to say like I tearfully cried as I wrote it. The intention was to make this entertaining and comedic and make sure that like it's a long form sketch show. So what I more mean to say is that I think what connects my work, and this is far longer to say than the word comedian, is I take what hurts me. I let it pass through me, and then I try and find an accessible way to share that with the world.
Cool.
Yeah.
And the roots of that creative process began in theater largely?
Yeah. So when I was, you know, when you're in high school or middle school and you're like, I like creative work. And they're like, great, be an actor. You know, that's like the only option. You're like, there's so many other things I could be.
No, nope, that's it.
But that's it. That's like the main in. I knew I wanted to essentially perform, and that was the option.
Mm-hmm.
And I – so kind of the overarching way that I see my creative evolution is like a slow chipping away or a carving of like ultimately the sculpture that will be the true me and maybe – eternally, I will be sculpting away and figuring that out.
That's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure. I'm still sculpting. My arms are so tired. My wrists are in bad shape. But like, so the quickest way to put it is in middle school and high school, I was like, well, it even started younger before like my voice changed in puberty. I was like, I'm going to be a musical theater actor. I can sing. And then puberty happened and I was like, I really can't sing. And that was just like some luck of like finding a piano that matched my voice. And then, you know, I really found that I loved performing. So I was like, let's do acting. And I even chipped away at that further when I got to college, when I realized it's not like necessarily acting and like learning Shakespeare or Tennessee Williams that I love, but in fact, like creating work that engages people.
Yeah.
Right. So I found sketch comedy and that was just mind blowing to me. I really fell in love immediately. In college, that's where I met Joe Firestone. We wrote Ridgefield Middle School Talent Night there together and did some other stuff. And then I had a bit of like an existential crisis with comedy, which was like, what am I saying with it? Like, is my only goal to make people laugh? And I just want to be super clear. That is a really noble goal if you just want to make someone have a good time. I just didn't feel like that was what I was best suited to do. And I was like, why am I in this? Like, what am I trying to say with the comedy? How can the creative work I do say something?
Mm-hmm.
And does it have to be beholden to making people laugh? So there was like a 2-year period after graduating college where I was like really in the muck, kind of figuring stuff out. And by in the muck, I just mean trying to make a dent in this very difficult city. And I'm from this city, and still it felt hard to like, how does one even begin to start doing this stuff?
Sure.
And I mentioned this, and I see it as part of my creative process, but I like essentially had to muster up the courage to get to apply to a job at Whole Foods in Chelsea as a cashier so that I could save up money and move out of my mom's place.
Sure.
And it was like that in this existential crisis of kind of wondering what I wanted to do with my art. Apologies to all your listeners who just barfed at how pretentious that was. But that's what it felt like in this like existential moment of being like, what am I? What do I want to do? I know that I want to do comedy, but like, what am I saying with that comedy? It took like a very slow motion of mustering up the courage to do what might seem insignificant to people.
Yeah.
So like applying to a job at Whole Foods felt like a huge deal to me, right? It felt like a step forward. And then from that, applying to a job to be a cashier at a to-go counter at a restaurant felt like a big deal to me. Asking the manager of that restaurant to be trained as a barista, that felt like a huge deal to me. A huge leap forward was like, can I muster up the courage to ask to be trained as a server, right? So this slow like climb in the restaurant industry and the service industry, which I have to say I loved. A lot of people look back on those years and they're like, oh God, I hate them. But it's like I loved working in the service industry.
Why does that feel like it's such an important part? Like, why is that related to the creative process for you?
Because I think that was like my testing period to see if I could muster up the courage to do anything.
Okay.
And it was when I kind of like, got the chutzpah to ask my manager to be a server, I was like, why am I focusing so much on an industry that I have never been interested in working with food or being a chef, or managing a restaurant, however amazing those jobs are. So I was like, why don't I like refocus this on like what I'm actually here for? So I was familiar with a theater company, the New York Neo-Futurists, and I auditioned. And I got into the company, and I was with them for 4 years.
Cool.
And that was incredible. For people who don't know, the New York Neo-Futurists, they have a pretty strict aesthetic of like non-illusory theater, which just essentially means you're not playing characters, you're not pretending to be anywhere you aren't. So there was like that seems very limiting, but in fact, it was like very freeing. We have a short form. They have a short form show every Friday and Saturday here in New York City. And I just felt like I was writing a ton, right? When you're working through like a huge volume of work, like that Ira Glass quote, you feel just like you're getting better and better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting closer to like what you want to say and your point of view and all of that stuff. I know that I'm rambling so much.
What year was that? How long ago was that?
That was 2012 when I joined.
Yeah, I'm very aware of that show. I love that show.
Mm-hmm.
That show is actually what led me here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was sort of out of, on a performance side, I was out of that world. I was doing more like TV and like film type production jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to that show with a friend like probably 2008.
Yeah.
And
In New York.
In New York.
Yeah.
And whatever, I don't know, like there was a bit that had you give out name tags,
mm-hmm.
right?
At the beginning of every show, you get a name tag.
And for whatever reason, the name tag that I got was a bit that got pulled up on stage,
uh-huh.
and somebody from the back shouted things or asked me questions and like shouted at me. And it was really fun.
Yeah.
And I was like, but it was also like very improv-y in that like, yeah. it was, I was trying to like, you were trying to be like honest about it, but it was like very personal questions
oh,
that
yeah.
you were asking.
Yeah.
And it was just so much fun to do.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, I should try, I should get it, I should try that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That improv like art form.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And yeah.
it sort of like was a
and
direction.
So that got you into improv.
It was very much like a kick in the ass to be like, oh yeah, take that class.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that's amazing.
So I'm very familiar with that show.
Oh my God, great.
And I think that stuff is great.
Yeah. And you know, I love their work. I loved being part of it. It's also, I think that really informed like this kind of liminal space I occupy of what am I?
Yeah.
Because there was no edict to do comedy.
Yeah.
A lot of times the work that came out was like hilarious, but you could also like then write a harrowing short form play, yeah. as they call it. And, you know, and you're like listening to a voicemail of someone who just recently passed away,
yeah.
and then the audience is crying, and then a minute later they're doing a dance to a Demi Lovato song.
Sure. Yeah, it definitely felt like it was crossing a lot of different genres, mm-hmm. and it also, and I guess it also feels like that so much of the work that was towards the beginning of your career here
mm-hmm.
feels like it was, yeah, it was sort of like you have been crossing those genres
yeah.
from the beginning.
Yeah.
But in that sort of theater space where it feels like you were doing a lot of stuff to start,
mm-hmm.
it is like such a, so many of those ideas feel like they're sort of like experiential and mm-hmm. immersive, and like you have to, like being there was part of what the ideas were about.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
it's a good way to put it.
Too much light probably doesn't work on TV.
Yeah. No. And we talked about that a lot of like, how can we do more video? And that's really how I started getting into video is just by making a ton of video for them. But no, it works live and with an audience and with that audience in that night, in that space. And then it's that exact feeling is never going to be replicated again. And that's so cool.
Yeah.
Right? It's like Snapchat before Snapchat.
So at the early stages of it, you're acting mostly, or are you also, and writing?
Writing.
Well?
I think that's when I started really more identifying as like a writer. Because
mm-hmm.
The writing came first, and then you are writing to then perform it. Structuring your writing and all of that stuff. And again, just because I was able to like write a ton,
yeah.
that's how you get better.
Yeah.
So.
And what's the first thing that sort of breaks through for you? Is that the cut down, the movie cut downs?
Yeah,
every single word?
You know, there's a string of things. One is through the Neo-Futurists, I met Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink, who made the podcast Welcome to Night Vale.
Yeah.
Who make the podcast Welcome to Night Vale.
Oh, and that's before, okay.
And that's before. So they cast me in Welcome to Night Vale.
Cool.
And that was really eye-opening for me. I mean, being cast in it was a huge honor, but the real honor was being really close to the two of them and, you know, traveling the country with them whenever we went on tour, because I was seeing very up close hard work and determination pay off. And that sounds so, like, trite and just like, blah, blah, blah. But what I mean by that is that, you know, I had also seen them before the podcast exploded. I had seen them start the podcast in May of 2012, continue doing it for a year when no one was really listening, and then I watched it explode 13 months later. So it was just so cool to see that the ideas that we can be nursing for a while can then become these like viable jobs that bring us around the country.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
That is cool. What was the thing that turned for that show?
Nobody really knows. There was one day where I think they got like 1.5 million downloads or something. And that was like multiple times what they had gotten in total for the like 13 months before.
Wow.
Yeah. And then it just found this huge audience. And really what happened that summer is that for the whole summer, it dethroned This American Life as the top podcast. Mm. And so that's like this feedback loop where everyone's like, what's the number one podcast? I want to listen to it.
Sure.
And they're downloading it and discovering it. So this is just to say that Welcome to Night Vale was like a really eye-opening for me, just to see these two people who I really, really respect creating something just so cool and getting to travel with them and like seeing their minds at work. In 2015, I made the first series that kind of put me on the map, which is Every Single Word, the video series that edits down movies to only the words spoken by people of color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but it was sort of like, so you're sort of like seeing the process of something that's like a project of passion find its audience without necessarily even... without changing anything about its about what it's doing.
No.
They also weren't doing anything different from when it was a passion project to when it became sort of like successful in a from a download standpoint.
Yeah. You know, when you just asked that, I remembered something else that really inspired me about that, which is that which is what I felt was so enabling for me with joining the Neo-Futurists is like you don't have to wait for permission to be an artist. No one has to give you the keys to be like, well, now you're an artist, now you're a creator, now you're a comedian. You get to actually determine when you are. And they didn't wait for permission to make that show. They just did it, and it wasn't the hit that it is today, but they loved making it, and they poured their souls into making it when it didn't have a sizable audience, and then it did.
I wonder, so much of that, though, is also about, like, yes, you're absolutely right, but it also, to go back to what you were saying about applying to Whole Foods, some of it is about having the courage to put yourself out there.
Yeah.
And I think that's a hard hurdle for people to get over.
Oh, absolutely. It took me so long. Like, I see people now in the comedy community who are like, 22 and 23 and are just like doing things left and right, just creating stuff. And I'm like, I look at them in awe because I know that I took longer to have the courage to like put anything out there to create. So also everyone's on their own time. And I really hate when people like choose certain ages to make themselves feel like they're old. Like, I've seen 40-year-olds completely dismantle and then rebuild their career. 50-year-olds, you know?
Sure.
There
is no, there's definitely no singular path. I think that people tend to do that because you sort of like are comparing yourself to a, however you define your peer set. Too,
exactly. Right? Exactly.
And also, you always, I think you always feel bad about where you are. I think you could be very successful in this business and still feel like, what the fuck am I doing? What's that other person doing that's better or smarter? Where's my value?
Where's my value? You know, sometimes I think the most subversive thing you can do is be proud of yourself. And like, I think if you really want to say fuck you to the man, you're like, I think I'm doing well. No matter where you are.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like, and now I finally reached that place. I'm saying like, when I was at Whole Foods, I think I remember telling my mom, like, I feel like I've made it. And that's not a joke.
Yeah.
I did. I felt like I had, at the time, I felt like I had made it.
Yeah.
Because I had, I know this sounds so insignificant, but I had done this thing that I didn't think I could do. I thought I was, I just didn't understand how to even like begin making money in New York City, you know? And I'm from here, right?
Yeah.
I'm like supposed to be the smart city kid, and I'm like terrified to apply to a job at Whole Foods. So,
I mean, it also feels like, and I want to talk about Every Single World and every single word and what's happened since then, but like to think about sort of like making these choices, it also feels like, and it feels like from the work that you do and talking to you, that like you're very mindful of what are the choices that I am making? What are the choices that I'm making? And I think that I also think that like making choices, even when they are small, that are going to make you feel like you're accomplishing things, and also making choices that are going to make you happy with your life, even at that point. Because like I definitely had that too in the past, where like I took a job that isn't necessarily like what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
But even that job brought me some joy.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and also to recognize when you're in a job or in a project or in a position in life where this thing isn't making me happy.
Yeah.
We're in a relationship where this isn't making me happy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To say that, like, this isn't for me.
Right, right.
To have that sort of, like, self-acknowledgement of, like, the kind of choices you're making, feel like it informs, like, being able to move forward in a way that you're going to be happy with. You know what I mean?
No, I
being okay with happiness, too. Saying fuck the man by saying I'm willing to admit that I can be happy.
Yeah. You put that perfectly. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You did it.
Well, just because so many people think they have to be an artist, you have to suffer.
Yeah.
You have to be unhappy in order to do the thing the right way.
And then I also think that then what that creates, and don't get me wrong, sometimes making stuff feels like a version of suffering, a very fortunate version of suffering, but it feels tough. But I also think, and I'm calling myself out on this, in that it takes one to know one, is that sometimes there's this performative suffering. And you're like, am I really suffering? You know, like, is this actually miserable?
Uh-huh.
It's not miserable. And, you know, I do want to acknowledge, like, I have been in many writing projects that I've been, you know, if I've written something myself and I just, like, feel like in the deep woods of not knowing anything and I'm like, who am I anymore, you know?
Yeah.
But then I also think sometimes I catch myself, like, performing suffering and I'm like, all right, let's go easy, you know?
Yeah.
This is not so bad.
So flashing forward to every single word.
Every single word.
You start that project again. So that's not a, I mean, it's not a comedy project, right? It's not funny.
Yeah, it's. about to say it's funny. No, but it is interesting that you say that because everyone started complimenting me by saying these are hilarious, and I was like, oh, it's interesting that that is how it's reading to you.
Yeah, you know? At its core, but it's not meant to be like, oh, this is a hilarious thing. That was statement.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know. So again, like I said at the beginning, I try and take what hurts me, let it pass through my body, and then make it more accessible for other people. And this was something I had been dealing with for a while, kind of hitting a wall in the industry at every time I was meeting with agents.
Yeah.
This happened in high school when I was acting in plays and casting directors would come to my shows and they would call me in, you know, for auditions, and then they'd set me up with meetings with agents, and the agents would, you know, compliment my talent and then tell me it would be unlikely that I would get work. Didn't understand how the two went together, but I was a 16, 17-year-old at the time, so you just accept whatever an adult tells you. Flash forward to towards the end of my time with the New York Neo Futurists, I wrote a play, and it was nominated for a Drama Desk Award. That's like an award that the industry acknowledges, and I was also in Welcome to Night Vale, and I was like, great, I'm going to, like, try and get an agent. Again, same thing. We love your work. We think you're doing such great stuff. You're too specific to get work. And that's a word they use, specific. I didn't understand what they meant. And I was also furious at the suggestion that I was talented enough to get work, but because of who I am, unlikely to get it. And I didn't accept that as an answer as I did when I was 16, 17, because I was like, fuck yeah. You know, like, I'm an adult now, and I see much more bigger systemic things here. So I wanted to figure out how to share that with people. And I could have, I suppose, gone a number of ways. I could have started writing a series of essays about representation in Hollywood. I could have started writing about the barriers of entry that people who are quote-unquote specific face. But I was like, I want to make sure that, like, as many people can see this in front of their eyes as possible. And so, you know, I had written a play, a short piece for the New York Neo Futurists, which was called Every Single Word, spoken by a person of color in the Julia Louis-Dreyfus movie Enough Said, as performed by the only person of color in tonight's show. And I did. I just performed all of it, and it was 45 seconds, and then it was it, and the audience loved it. They just thought it was hilarious. But then there's that bitter aftertaste, right,
yeah,
where you're like, this is funny. Oh, Into the Woods has no people of color, you know? So that was the first time that I kind of really started realizing that I can, if I do things that are coming from a very true place, and a place where I'm trying to say something, but I find a very, but I sugarcoat it and find an accessible way to say it to people. People can interpret it however they want. Some people think it's the funniest video series they've ever seen. And, you know, some people are crying because of what it's showing them. And I love that. I love that people can have different reactions to it. And I also love that it's accessible. And that kind of started me on the path of realizing the potency of doing digital work and finding ways to make bite-sized digital work that is accessible, that kind of speaks to bigger issues.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it also happens at a time where that digital, the world of digital communication, I feel like there's been a, since that time mm-hmm. when you were doing that project, mm-hmm. even since then, mm-hmm. the amount of content on the internet is exploding.
Oh, my God.
Because not only is it the sort of like, there was a period of time where it was like the user-generated stuff and the stuff from like small creators, and it was passion. It mm-hmm. felt like there was like so much out there that was like being ignored by big corporations
yeah.
and media companies.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they all decided, oh, no, we need to flood this market too. Yeah.
And that's inevitable, right? Like it's the way I think about it is like it's almost like a form of digital gentrification, right?
Yeah.
The way gentrification works is that communities live in a certain neighborhood. You know, there is this like authenticity to that neighborhood because it's a community of people in community together. They create art and they create a language of that community. And then rich people are like, let's develop there. It's cool. Mm-hmm. It's fun. And that's essentially what has happened to the digital space.
Yeah, and it also feels like, you know, to take a step backwards to Night Vale, too, it's like that was also happening at a time where, like, because now you look at the podcast landscape, and it's like there's so many.
So many podcasts.
So many.
There are true, like, I remember the top 10 podcasts were, like, all podcasts you knew and recognized, and now it's like I don't even know what the top podcast is sometimes. Yeah.
And so much of where something like that breaks through, it's also somewhat a product of excellent timing.
Oh, yeah.
The same thing could happen now, and the results might be different because mm-hmm. I've definitely been at meetings mm-hmm. with big corporations where what they say is, yeah, we just flood it. Mm-hmm. We just turn all of our stuff into podcasts because why not?
Yeah.
And it means that if it's the Starbucks model of the coffee shop,
mm-hmm.
Starbucks in total can eat up X of the market,
mm-hmm.
then all the little coffee shops go away and they get more.
Right.
It's a matter of like flood it, mm-hmm. get your share, dilute mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And so it feels like that's good timing mm-hmm. that a project like this, the project like Every Single Word's happening at a time where like that was a Tumblr project too, right?
It was actually YouTube, but I made a Tumblr for it so that it could all live in one place, and everyone refers to it as a Tumblr.
Okay,
yeah,
it feels like that's happening at a point where we're not quite at that moment where all these companies are so invested. Like it feels like in the last like 2 years they've like turned on the switch of like
mm-hmm.
we're now bought into this.
Oh yeah,
right.
Oh yeah.
Does that project lead to the job at Seriously? In a direct way?
Essentially, indirectly, yeah. So the irony is that I made that series because of these, like, endless meetings with agents where they were like, well, we don't want to work with you. You're too specific. And then that project got me an agent, which is like, it took this, you know?
Now they're like, you're so specific.
Yeah, I know. We love it. No, the truth is I met a great agent who I really loved, and she kind of was – she never used the word specific, and that's what made me be like, yeah, let's work together, you know, because, she kind of – and also, you know, to give credit to the universe, I suppose, I also was projecting something a little more nuanced than just being like, well, I want to be an actor, right? So I started working with her after Every Single Word. I was like, where do I go from here? Do I like just go on the college speaking circuit and talk about social justice issues? And then, you know, I auditioned, wrote a packet for this new company that was being started by Verizon Hearst Media Partners, Seriously TV. And I was like, oh, well, I'm an independent artist, you know, like I made every single word in my in my bedroom on iMovie, and I put it out on Free Things, and I'm on Welcome to Night Vale, which is an indie podcast, and I'm part of the Neo Futurists, which is like a downtown performance art group. Will this ruin my indie cred? And I eventually resolved, like, no, this is a really cool next step where I can, all of the ideas that I've been nursing for years and years and years, I can kind of see them into, you know, see them into fruition. Is that a phrase?
I mean, see, I understand what you mean.
See them into fruition. Yeah, it's a phrase now.
Mm-hmm.
I could see them into fruition and kind of water them and watch them grow with resources that I never, ever, ever had access to before. So, yeah, because I was so hungry for an opportunity, I really just, like, took the Seriously TV opportunity and like, sprinted with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it also feels like, I think that it seemed like there was some evolution there what they were over the course of time.
Yeah.
But I remember when it first launched, it was sort of like news. It was like trying to be like something journalistic while, and speaking to sort of like social issues, I guess, while also being comedic.
Yeah.
Right? It was sort of like news and comedy put it together.
Yeah.
Short form.
Yeah. Short form pieces of like The Daily Show, Last Week Tonight, sprinkled throughout the day.
Because there also has been in the world as well, right? Comedy has also become a mechanism for exploring real issues in a way that also wasn't necessarily so prevalent even 10 years ago, right?
No. And I think The Daily Show really, like, The Daily Show revolutionized it.
It really did.
Yeah.
And I think there's been, like, different innovations that have happened since then. Mm-hmm. But it felt like this was, like, a short form or sort of like a – I say short form, but like a digital content approach at doing it their way.
Oh, totally.
Right?
Yeah.
And in terms of, like, going at that, it also looked like – from the outside, it looked like another opportunity to do a lot of reps. You guys were heavy volume, right? You were doing
heavy
content.
Volume, yes.
How long were you there? How many pieces did you
I was – oh, God. I have a spreadsheet somewhere. I think I made 115 videos. That's a lot.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's nuts. And, you know, something to just say about Seriously, and I mean this as no shade to the people who hired me – but they didn't want me to be on camera at first. And this feels like an overarching theme that I've experienced in my life, but, like, kind of being underestimated for, like, okay, well, like, let's, you know, okay, fine, we'll let you in, but let's see what you can do. And it's that motivates you to be like, watch me.
Yeah.
Like, I'll show you. And that's why I just, like, put everything I had into the stuff I did there.
I think that and it definitely seems apparent. I'll say that of the stuff that was happening there from the outside, your stuff was the most visible. That's how I feel.
Oh,
my opinion.
Thanks. I mean, yeah, to be clear, a lot of people there were doing really, really great work. I was fortunate to meet really amazing, really smart, really funny people.
Yeah.
I loved everyone I worked with there. What I do feel really fortunate about is that they started understanding that I had, in fact, been working in the digital space for many years before this company, and I wasn't coming at this from, like, just the comedy perspective. So they started giving me license to kind of craft my own stuff, produce my work, write my work, and kind of see it through from inception to conception. You know, they gave me a lot of creative license, again, because I just, like, worked my ass off there.
Yeah.
And I feel very fortunate that my videos started to be pretty widely shared and kind of developed an audience that was cool.
And you kind of answered it, but it also made me wonder,
mm-hmm,
how much of, because again, you're not necessarily defining yourself and your work as a comedian, mm-hmm. but there's a at a company like that, it also is satire in some way.
Completely.
So even the things that you were doing that felt like they were, like that whole unboxing series, that's satire.
Oh, 100%.
In execution, it's funny, but but like how much of in the creation in that environment was there the pressure to make it comedic versus make it socially, you know, exploring some sort of social topic and really like digging into that versus also making it something that has a high likelihood of virality, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the virality, I actually really think it's so hard to control. You just have to like make sure you're making stuff that you think will work. I do have to say the thing about the internet, though, is like the more simply you can present it and then get complicated in structure or in the way you do it, that's kind of like what succeeds on the internet. But there is one person that I just want to shout out, which is that my boss there, the channel leader, was Ethan Berlin. Have you ever met him or worked with him? He's amazing. And I've said this to his face, and I'm saying it now into many people's ears, but he's the best critic of work that I've ever worked with. And he's like that amazing English professor or writing teacher who like reads your work and makes sure to give you notes to make it sound more like you, you know? And that's what he had the ability to do. He was just so funny. But that even just saying like he's so funny feels like, well, that's like not even cracking the surface of what he is. He's so funny. He's so smart. And he has this ability to read a script, see what you're going for, and sculpt it to be more you.
That's great.
Yeah, and so he, I felt really enabled by him there and really supported by him. Behind any, like, success story is that person and those people, right? The people who are just amazing at their job and really make you feel like you're doing something cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 115 videos. Seriously, that's a hell of a lot of work.
I'm getting that tattooed on my body.
You're not there anymore. They've changed direction. Mm-hmm. You're now back. Are you like freelance? You don't have do you have a day job now? What is life? I guess what's a typical week like?
What's
now?
A typical week like? Oh God, it's nuts. And by nuts I mean it's like those weeks that are like the busiest weeks you've ever had, and then like the weeks where you're like, hello?
Yeah.
I have not spoken to a human. The big thing that that happened when I left Seriously is that there was a project that I always knew I wanted to work on, which is that ever since I started Every Single Word, ever since I started doing public work digitally, I had been getting hateful comments, hateful messages, which is, as we all know, it's going to happen on the internet.
It is such a part of
the part of internet culture.
Yeah,
and as someone who, at a time, whose only option was making work on the internet, I just had to accept this. This is just how it went. And I say that just because the internet was the way that I could get my work out there without the permission of the gatekeepers who told me I was too specific. And so ever since Every Single Word, I knew that I wanted to make a project with that. How was I going to make that project? What was I going to do? So really the main thing I've been working on since I left Seriously was my podcast, Conversations with People Who Hate Me. And so I just wrapped that. Essentially, it's exactly what the title is. I have long extended conversations with some of the people who have sent me negative or hateful messages on the internet. That's the main project that I've been working on, and also other projects here and there. I did a video series for Fusion, tasted wines, tasted old comedies to as if they were wines to see how they've aged. And then I also just had the total honor of working on Francesca Ramsey's new show, which was really, really cool. Yeah, that is like my first official television job. So even in all of this career, I don't know, time that I've been working, I this was my first time cracking into what people would call an official television job. So,
yeah, I mean, I want to dig into some of that stuff, especially the podcast and sort of like where that sort of like creatively has led you. Mm-hmm. But you just brought it up, television cracking into it. Does that matter to you? Like, I guess like when you're thinking about the future, sculpting the you that you want, does that matter? Where are you going?
So, you know, it matters to me only because it's learning a new skill set and working with people I really admire and getting to be in a writer's room. What I hate so much is when I work on digital projects and people who I'm even working on it with remind me that it's not real TV. And I'm like, what are you getting out of this? You know, like, we're working on this together. Who are you trying to prove this to? So I don't at all like value linear television, broadcast television, more than digital, because I think they both take a tremendous amount of creative energy and work. And I really believe that if you're making work that you're proud of and two people are consuming it, you should be really proud of yourself. But I think, you know, getting into a writer's room as I was in for this pilot feels really cool because it's just a space that I hadn't yet at the time been granted access to. So I wanted to see what it was like. I got to work with just the most amazing, smart people. And I felt like I learned from them a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think sometimes, too, it's also like, it's also so hard in digital to make even a comfortable living.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that's happened in the last few years in New York is that it's gotten so much more expensive.
Oh, my God.
So yeah. There's something about television that feels like it's, even though it's crumbling, it's stable. Or at least that you can like bank some money that then if you have a dry patch, you're not completely on your ass.
Oh, yeah. And I've also been very consciously saving money ever since I was a server, right? Yeah. Like any excess that I had. And there was a time when I lived like so frugally that all I ate was free food from my restaurants and then peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So like I stowed it away.
Yeah.
And by stowed it away, it sounds like I have like millions in the bank. Yeah. I mean stowed, you know. $50 a week away, but $50 a week after
if you're making
many
it
years.
Go far,
yeah.
And then if you also have that mindset, you can make it go far.
And do you know how many peanut butter and jelly sandwiches $50 a week is? That's a lot. Yeah,
a lot.
Yeah,
no, but and I think that's also an important skill in this, like even that sort of like balance of being able to stretch money, to be able to be conscious of that, to give yourself some ability to like exist and also take chances on the things that you want to do.
Yeah,
it also feels like it's an important part of.
Yeah.
Being an artist who isn't miserable.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's been kind of piecemeal. Also, one of the main things I do for like paid work is, ever since Every Single Word, I've been getting requests to like speak at colleges.
Yeah.
And again, those veer more towards like, social justice conversations.
Sure.
And I love having those.
And in terms of thinking about the future, what are the kind of projects that drive you going forward?
Mm.
Like, you don't seem like somebody who, and maybe I'm wrong here, you don't seem like somebody who wants to like move to LA and get into that Hollywood scene.
I would get into the Hollywood scene if there was an opportunity to do what I really want to do, which is like carve a space out in television or digital television or anywhere to kind of make a show. I feel like I've spent, a good how long have I officially been doing this? I don't know, maybe like 11 years since I've like really zeroed in on the fact that I want to be taking this very seriously. And I want to create a show that kind of brings together all the different things that I've been doing. What does that look like? Is it a talk show?
I mean, that's definitely something that I've thought of. I wouldn't want it to be a carbon copy of anything that already exists.
Sure.
There's a lot I want to do.
But you don't have a studio screenplay in your pocket.
No, I don't.
You don't. You're not aspiring to be writing
the
those
next
kind of
Jay Leno.
Yeah. Yeah, or even that. But I think that's why it feels like.
Yeah.
New York is a good place for the kind of work that
yes.
you're doing because
totally.
There's more people yeah. around. There's also this like,
yeah.
like there's a little bit of like a grinding ethos, yeah. like what you're yeah. building.
Right. You're right. And also another thing I just want to point out is that what I really appreciate about this conversation is usually conversations about creativity kind of end at a plateau of like, and now I've made it, you know, and life is good and I feel great. But the truth is I'm really still figuring it out.
Yeah.
Like I'm submitting packets to shows you know, less auditioning because I'm really done going in for auditions where I'm the sassy gay assistant to the lead woman, you know,
sure.
or man. And I would rather create roles for myself that are a little juicier than that.
Mm-hmm.
But bless those roles. You know, they put food on the table.
Bless them.
Bless them. But I think, yeah, something that has been really great about making a podcast is that I really do have creative control
yeah.
over what it is. And if I had pitched that to a television exec, they would have been like, where's the debate? You know, where's the drama?
Sure.
Are you yelling at each other? And I'm like, no, we actually peacefully listen to each other. And they're like, oh, God, this won't sell at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just continue making my work and kind of seeing what's next.
Yeah.
Seeing where my mind takes me. Or where a job opportunity takes me. Honestly, yeah. I'm open.
Some yeah. of it is like you can't control it.
Yeah.
It's like something
yeah,
shows exactly. up and you're like, yeah, that's fun.
Right.
I'll do that.
I feel very primed and ready to just say yes to an opportunity that excites me.
Cool.
I'm just looking to like, oh, this is going to sound so silly, but to learn. I want to learn. I like being around people who I really admire. I like being around people who I think are really smart.
Yeah.
And so working with people who are, you know, really good at what they do, no matter what the field is, always, like, really makes me feel cool.
Dig it.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I want to ask about is on the podcast, and it feels like this mm-hmm. is also, like, a skill that you have.
Mm-hmm.
You're working with people who aren't performers. You're
yes.
working with people who aren't actors at all.
Yeah.
There's no script.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like that, like the podcast isn't meant to be funny
no.
in a traditional sense where you're no. like, this has to be hilarious. There are moments of levity,
mm-hmm.
especially in how uncomfortable it can mm-hmm. be at times. But you're also getting great things out of people who aren't coming at it thinking I'm a performer or I'm doing this
yes.
as a performance.
Yeah.
What has that been like for you? How what's your approach to like getting great things out of people who aren't necessarily like
performers.
Open to or and also like you're yeah,
yeah.
performers or even like looking to like give you great
right.
content.
Well, those are my favorite people to work with. Meaning those are my favorite performers, non-performers. I just think you get the best stuff out of people who are not comfortable being in the spotlight.
Yeah.
You just get real good shit. And I, you know, Ridgefield Middle School Talent Night, we could say it started there because that's a pretty audience-involved show. The audience is essentially playing the audience of this middle school talent night, and,
mm-hmm.
and many of the audience members become integral characters to some of these people's lives unknowingly, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
I continued doing that with the Neo-Futurists. I mean, the play I mentioned before that I was nominated for a Drama Desk for, it's a play that was entirely performed by randomly selected audience members through a series of synced up, you know, instructional tracks that I recorded and put on iPods for them.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, literally I wrote a play and was like, instead of actors, I want randomly selected audience members to perform the entire thing.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. And I just find it so much more... is authentic like the stupidest word to use? Do you like that word?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. See, I'm just like looking for your approval. I'm like, will you yeah. like this?
No, this is a safe space to use the word authentic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. A safe space.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
so it feels what you get out of people who aren't performers is an authenticity that is very hard to come by.
Yeah.
And I love it so much. And that's why, like, truly, I feel like, you know, that's why I love documentaries. Yeah. And I'm talking about as a viewer now. Like, sure. I just love documentaries because you're like, wow, you are being a full human right now, you know, and I love that.
Yeah. And it also feels like, especially in that show, in mm-hmm. the podcast, that you also have this, and this is what, like, I don't know, all your work leads me to believe that you're a very mindful person. Mm-hmm. But on that show in particular, you're addressing people who have come, who unsolicited have sort mm-hmm. of like come at you. Mm-hmm. But you're also not trying to present their point of view. It feels like you're trying to give them an opportunity to explain themselves.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, is more decent than what I think a TV producer might push you towards, which is more like, fuck you right back, dude.
Yeah, yell at them. Yeah. Slap them. And I'm like, no, they're a human.
Yeah.
One of the things that, like, really inspired me with that is in the book, The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison's book, there's this character that she just makes you hate from page one. Yeah. He has done unspeakable things to the main character. And really unspeakable things. And then at a later chapter in the book, she gives you his life story. And you're like, fuck, do I love him now? Right? Like, when you hear someone's story, it's like that Mr. Rogers quote, when you hear someone's story, you can't help but love them. And I want to be super clear that I'm not equating the things that my guests on Conversations with People Who Hate Me have said to me with the unspeakable and fictional things that this character in The Bluest Eye did at all. My guests were exercising their First Amendment right, and he did many illegal things. His name is Charlie, is the character. And I just, like, when you hear someone open up about their circumstances or where they're coming from or why they said that, but then you start asking them more about them, I don't know, just like the world seems like a smaller, less terrifying place. And that's essentially what I think all my work is like just trying to make the world less terrifying.
Rad.
Yeah.
We'll leave it right there.
Okay, fuck,
that's a great way to go out. That's
less
a great
terrifying. Way to go out. Bye.
Yeah. Dylan, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
And that'll do it for episode number 64 of the UCB Digital Podcast. Thanks to Dylan Marin for sitting down and having that conversation with me. Check out all of his work, including Conversations with People Who Hate Me, available right now wherever good podcasts are sold. No, free. Free podcasts, just like this podcast. We're here every single Tuesday talking to you about your creative work, your filmmaking work, and we hope that this show is beneficial to you. If it is, give us a subscribe, a rating, and a review on iTunes.com/UCB Comedy. That's our home base for all things UCB Comedy podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and I guess I'm on Pinterest now, at UCB Comedy and UCB Digital. UCB Comedy's got new videos all the time, including our Facebook Lives every Wednesday at 2, a new live show. You can get involved with that. You can interact with those shows. New shows every single Wednesday, Facebook/UCB Comedy. As we said, we'll be back next Tuesday with another brand new episode. We're reading our book club book. Again, we'll tweet out the link to that, but we hope you'll join us in that project. A couple of weeks here, we've got our career tracker coming back. Excited to check in. Sophie, do you believe it's week 35 already?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Crazy.
So we're going to see how everybody's doing as the summer comes to an end and the fall kicks into gear. Hope you're doing well out there. We'll see you again next week. And until then, we'll see you on the internet.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.